Well, my name is Mel Malone. I'm from the Onondaga Nation, from the Haudenosaunee tribe. The Haudenosaunee are made up of actually like five different nations. There's the Mohawks, the Oneidas, the Senecas, the Cayugas, and the Onondagas. We lived in New York State and upstate along the Great Lakes. And, well, I think we're like one of the most unknown tribes because everybody always associates most Native Americans with, you know, with like the powwow style stuff, with like the big drums and stuff like that. But like I said before, you know, that's mostly because they lost like most of their culture, their language, and not too many of them really know too much about it. But like us, I don't really know how, but we were able to hold on to it, you know. Like we still have, you know, ceremonies that we do privately on our own reservation that aren't for outside people, you know. We don't invite people down there to watch them. There's no cameras and stuff like that in there. But yeah, like I mean, I know a lot of people know about like the Algonquins and the Hurons and stuff like that that lived around the area, but for some reason, like, my people are kind of swept under the rug. The reservation I grew up on, it was kind of, well, it was really private. Like, I don't know, they kind of keep to themselves. They don't really warm up to outsiders and stuff like that a lot. Like, they, it's not like a typical reservation. There's no police down there. There's no stores. There's really not a whole lot going on down there. It's not that big either, but, everything's really, really like deeply cultural based though. Like, you know, everybody goes to Longhouse, but not too many people speak the language. The language is kind of dying out, but, you know, as far as like culture, it's called the Longhouse religion, you know, and, everything kind of revolves around that from the time when you're a little kid, you know, from like listening to stories from elders to, you know, learning to sing songs and stuff like that. But, everybody takes it very seriously down there. It's not like a show for outsiders and stuff like that. It's more of like, you know, it's more deep to us. It's more important to us. Even like, you know, simple things like sports. I don't know if, anybody's ever heard of lacrosse, but that sport was started by my people and now it's a huge thing back east. You know, it's a big sport. It's kind of like hockey, but without the skates. But, it's, everything has a meaning, you know. Everything's considered important, you know what I mean? Like, to us, like, there's no, like, certain types of ceremonies that mean more than another one. Everything is considered important, you know, like from the songs to the speeches to, you know, like I said, the sports we play and stuff like that. Everything has meaning, you know. You're not supposed to count anything as having less or more value. Everything's important. There's a lot of stuff that goes on down there that I don't agree with because, and most of it actually comes from, another thing I wanted to touch on was the residential schools, like, that the Europeans set up when they came over here, because after, you know, they pushed us onto reservations, they still wanted to, kind of eradicate us, and instead of just coming down and, like, you know, murdering everybody, the one thing that they wanted to do to us was, kind of destroy who we were. So, like, you know, this isn't something that happened, like, thousands of years ago. This is recent. I remember my grandfather, he could speak fluent Onondaga, and he wouldn't teach it to me because he was afraid that someday the U.S. government would come down and take us away, too, like they took him away. They took him to these schools, these Catholic schools, and the nuns and priests, they would cut kids' hair off. They would beat them for speaking their language. They were sexually abused by priests. They were murdered, you know, because some kids that were taken away were really little. And if they didn't want to stop crying for their parents and stuff like that, they would take them out back and murder them. And then, they would, you know, write a letter home saying, oh, he died from tuberculosis or something like that, an accident. And it really traumatized a lot of the older generation. And the sad thing is they brought all that, the trauma and, like, the bad things back to the reservation with them, and they kind of repeated it onto the younger generation, and it just carried on. There's a lot of bad things that go on the reservation nowadays, and it's mostly due to the residential schools, but... the last one got shut down, I think, in, like, the early 2000s, but that was in Canada. But in Canada, I guess when they excavate certain areas for, like, a building foundation and stuff like that, they find, bodies and stuff like that, like, little kids' bodies and stuff, like, bones and stuff like that. There was actually a guy up there building a, some type of business up there, and, when he found, you know, these children's bodies up there, he actually stopped the excavation and donated a bunch of money to one of the reservations up there because he felt bad about, like, what happened. And, yeah, it's, see, like, everybody associates, you know, Native Americans with being killed off from the things like diseases and stuff like that. And that's one myth I wanted to kind of touch on, because it wasn't just diseases. They don't teach you this stuff in school, you know. They kind of give you a crash course real quick on Native Americans, and they sweep all the bad stuff under the rug. But, you know, like, I've seen the trauma and stuff like that that happens down there. I went through it with my grandfather. You know, he could speak fluent Onondaga, like I said, and he didn't want to teach us the language because of all the horrible things he went through. You know, and it's bad. But, you know, I'm proud of being Native and everything like that. But I had to get out of there, though, because, like I said, that, like, living down there, you know, there's a lot of bad that goes on down there. And a lot of child molestation, rape, people drinking themselves to death, a lot of drugs. You know, just the result of, like I said, the trauma from the boarding schools, because a lot of people came back from those places really messed up. And, you know, like, a lot of them turned to alcohol and drinking, and then a lot of them turned around and abused their own kids and their own family members the way they were abused in those schools. And it still shows today really bad, especially on my res, I think. I mean, I can't speak for other reservations, but I know on mine it does. And it's pretty crazy, because even the elders and the leaders, that the ones that are taking care of, like, our religious side, you know, and the longhouse and stuff like that, they're some of the ones that have, like, you know, committed these things against people. But because they speak the language and because they're religious and stuff like that, they kind of get like a pass. And it's sad, you know, like, people down there are stealing money. My reservation's really rich. I mean, we sell cigarettes, like, millions of dollars worth of cigarettes, and it stays just within this small little group of people. And then you have some people that are living in trailers with no water or no heat, living in broken down little shacks and stuff. People drinking themselves to death, and it's bad. I mean, I could tell you a lot of nice things about, like, how things used to be for Native Americans, you know, before pre-Europeans, but if you want to know about, like, modern day Native Americans and how it is to live on a reservation, it's bad. It really is. It's horrible. And, you know, like I said, I'm proud of being Native. I'm glad we held on to our culture and everything like that, but, you know, I think the world needs to know about, like, all the atrocities that the United States committed against Native Americans, you know, and they kind of swept us under the rug. And there's always a myth going around that the United States government gives us all kinds of money and stuff. I don't get any money from the U.S. government. Not every reservation does. See, the way it works is, if you sell your people out and you put a casino on your res, you're signing a deal basically with the federal government. And then after you put a casino on your res, you will get a check. But the U.S. government takes a majority of that money. You're just getting a cut of it. And then also, that takes away your sovereignty. It gives the U.S. government, the federal government, permission to come down there and basically do whatever they want on your reservation. You basically sold your res for a check. Like, my reservation, we don't have a casino, but we still have our sovereignty. We control it. When you step onto our res, it's like stepping into another country. Yeah, but I mean, I went back there every now and then, but I just, one big thing that I really don't agree with down there is all the inbreeding, because, like, everything's really closed. Like, there's cousins marrying cousins, because there's this whole... Because in our culture, to be Onondaga, your mother has to be Onondaga. So it's like everybody tries to marry in. Everybody wants to be Onondaga. So they don't really venture out too much. Like, my uncles, they all married, you know, people from off the res, white women. But, I mean, I respect that, though, because it's better than inbreeding. You know what I mean? But the sad thing is, though, is, like, they don't realize that, like, there's not enough of us to, like, the eradication of the American Indian really did work. Because even if Europeans packed up, all the white people packed up, all the black people packed up all their stuff and went back where they came from, we wouldn't be able to come back. We would just inbreed. There's no chance for us coming back. We have to start mixing out with other people, because there's no chance for us. There's not enough of us. Oh, yeah, like, in the longhouse, like speaking my language and participating in ceremonies and stuff, I was always proud of that. But just the dark side of it. And, you know, when I was younger, I was always really happy down there. I always liked it a lot. And then I started to notice these things and hear these things about these people. And, you know, my parents always kept me at home. They never let me venture out too far on my own and stuff like that. And when I grew up, I kind of learned why. Because, you know, they knew, like, a lot of horrible things were going on in these other houses and stuff like that. And they didn't want me around these people. And then, you know, when I grew up and learned all that stuff, I left. But, you know, my parents always... exposed me to a lot of different stuff. They didn't just keep me on the res, you know, sheltered. they would take me off the res to meet people, you know. I traveled a lot. I've been, even when I was younger, you know, I've been all over the place. Like, when I was little, my dad moved us out to Washington State. I've been to Alaska. I've been everywhere. So we spent a lot of time in the city, you know, meeting people. My dad had a lot of friends that didn't live on the res, you know. We didn't just spend all our time on the res. But the sad thing is, though, is there is a lot of natives down there that's their world, you know. Like, they don't really venture too far out from the reservation. They spend all their time down there, and they don't want to leave. I mean, the world's huge. There's a lot of stuff to see out there, and I'm glad I got the chance to leave, actually. I mean, like I said, though, I am proud of being Native, and I'm proud of, you know, our culture and our religion and stuff like that. But living on the res is hard because people get dependent on it down there, and some people, it is a shock for them to leave, you know. Like, they don't know what to do, how to handle stuff. Like, when I left, I had to learn about, you know, getting an ID and a social security card and a birth certificate. I had to figure out how to do all that stuff on my own, you know. It was pretty hard at first, but I'm glad I learned how to do it. Well, I travel a lot anyways. I mean, I do a lot of different work. I'm a carpenter. I cook. I do all kinds of stuff. I mean, I'm good at learning how to do stuff, but I can attribute that to my parents. You know, they were always on me about, you know, getting out of my comfort zone. They never let me get too comfortable in one little area. You know, they wanted me to, like I said, they exposed me to a lot. They wanted me to, be able to, flourish in any kind of environment. You know, I think if I had stayed on the reservation, though, I think I would have been a lot worse off. Like, I wouldn't have sought any kind of help or anything like that. You know, a lot of them down there are really scared to ask for help and stuff like that. But, yeah, I like to travel. I like to see different places. I've been everywhere. I've been to Washington, Alaska. I've been all over down south. I've been through a lot of states and stuff like that. And I'm glad. But, you know, I'm getting older, and I'm kind of looking for a place to, like, chill out now and settle down. My mom left us when I was a kid. I'm not really sure where she's at. But my dad, he's back in upstate New York in Syracuse. He lives off the res, though, and he's a truck driver. He's getting ready to retire, actually, and he's just... you know, doing the same stuff. He's actually from Alaska. He's native from up there. He's a Aleut. But I claim to be Onondaga, though, because, like I said, most native tribes, we go by our mothers. Whatever our mother is, that's what we are. You know, like, my mother's Eel Clan, so I'm Eel Clan. She's Onondaga, so I'm Onondaga. And, that's where I got my name and everything, you know, Onondaga. My Indian name is Tohwanjadu. People, you know, they usually associate most Indians with, like, teepees and powwows and stuff like that. But, you know, we lived in longhouses because over in New York, you know, it's cold. You can't live in a teepee in the wintertime. Well, growing up, the elders used to always stress to us how important our culture and our language was, and how, you know, they would always tell us that you got to remember that your ancestors, people died for you to be here today. You know, it's important that you remember that and you keep... you know, your culture and your religion alive. They're like, it's scary to think that, like, when our elders are dying off. You know, I remember whenever somebody, an old person used to pass away in the community, they'd say, wow, he knew a lot, or she knew a lot, and everything she knew, you know, it's gone now. So you guys need to start learning stuff and start taking your culture and your religion and your people seriously. Because, you know, someday the Onondaga language could be gone. And it's kind of coming to that now, because, like, a lot of natives on my res are kind of becoming like the natives out here out west. They're more like powwow Indians. They like to just go out and sing and dance and for, you know, shows and money and stuff like that. But they don't really want to learn the language. They don't want to pay attention to how important the actual religion is itself. I call it a religion, but it's more like a way of life. It's more like what Indian culture really should be. It's a lot different. I mean, it could have been a lot worse, I guess. You know, we could have lost everything. We could have lost our culture, our religion, all that stuff. You know, our people, you know, we weren't dependent on the federal government like most Native Americans. You know, we were independent for a long time. We just, I think, recently got put on the federal rolls so we can apply for, like, federal aid and stuff like that. But, for a long time, we were kind of on our own. How do I put it? The main thing is to keep your own problems to yourself. You shouldn't do things that affect other people. I mean, they say that there's three main things that you can't, atone for to the creator. You can't repent for. It's, murder, rape, and, witchcraft. because you're putting out bad things to other people. Like, you can kind of repent for, you know, damaging yourself and hurting yourself, you know, with alcohol and drugs and, you know, whatever. But, like, when you cause problems for another human being, that's not right. You know what I mean? That's kind of what they believe. Like, you know, a lot of white people, they think, like, oh, you know, they pray to rocks and they pray to trees and stuff like that. No. The way we look at it is we hold ceremonies during certain seasons to, they say that we need to be thankful for everything, because if you stop being thankful for it, it'll stop. Because these things, these plants, these animals and stuff like that, they're here to help us. You know, they feed us, they take care of us. And when we stop appreciating them and thanking them, they think they're not needed and they'll go away someday. So the idea is to make sure that we let them know that they're needed through ceremonies and stuff like that. We have like a midwinter ceremony. We have a harvest ceremony. We have, actually we have a whole day, a couple of days devoted to strawberries. And, the idea, like I said, is just to make sure that they know that we appreciate them. You know what I mean? We're not praying to them. You know, we believe in a creator. We call him, Sungoyatiso. And, it means the great mystery. It's something that we don't understand. You know what I mean? But we're not supposed to understand it. You know, a lot of people always want to pursue like what's out there and stuff. A lot of people kind of forget to just be happy about the fact that we're here. We have a conscious mind. We're alive. We have free will. And we have food. We have water. Stuff like that. You know, you're supposed to enjoy this world and, you know, take your time with it and be happy. Not be worrying about the next life and stuff like that. The next life's going to come whether we want it to or not. We have a whole lifetime before we have to worry about that. And, yeah, a lot of it's important, mostly about just, taking care of yourself now, like living in the now. It's really kind of hard to explain. But yeah, most of it's about like not making your problems somebody else's problems. Like a lot of our traditions, our oral traditions, when you go to Longhouse, we don't just go in there and sing and dance. They recite the Gunahanyut, which is a Thanksgiving. The first thing they give thanks to is the earth. Then they give thanks to the people, the fact that the creator brought us here. And then they give thanks to things like medicines that grow low, medicines that grow high, foods, stuff like that. They give thanks to the weathers, stuff like that. And then they'll kind of like recount some kind of like a story almost. You know what I mean? To remember things. Like what we do a lot of times is we make these things called wampum belts, and it's like a picture, like a beaded, I don't know what you would call it. Well, like a, you know, like a belt. It's got a design on it, and the design's important. But the thing is every one comes with a story because it marks some kind of a historic event that happened in the past. You know, and like we had a big hand in like the Revolutionary War and stuff like that. Like if you ever read into like Ben Franklin or Thomas Jefferson or what's his name, George Washington, they talked about us a lot. A lot of Europeans used to call us the Romans of the New World because of how we dominated basically North America. And it's pretty crazy because like I look at how sad and like how beat up my people are nowadays. And it kind of makes me feel bad because I think about how we used to be and stuff like that. And, like, we used to be pretty, you know, good people. And the colonization thing kind of wrecked us. A lot of it, well, on the reservation, it's the addiction, the hopelessness. You know, there's a lot of drug dealing, a lot of drug using that goes on down there. It's just like a trap. Like you kind of get stuck there. It's kind of like living in a like a ghetto or something like that off the res. You know what I mean? Like a bad area. But same problems that go along with that. You know, drug abuse, alcoholism. But when you leave the reservation, I think the hardest challenge is all the stereotypes that people hear about you when you tell someone you're Native American. You know, like I said, they assume you get like lots of money and it's just easy to be Native and stuff like that. And you know, like a lot of it's got to do with the you know, people not being educated about it, though, because when you go to school, they don't teach you these things. They don't tell you that the U.S. government committed atrocities against these people, you know, and they don't talk about the fact that the U.S. committed a worse genocide that worked years and years, like hundreds of years before the Holocaust ever occurred. But they don't talk about that. Actually, Hitler got a lot of his ideas from the way that they treated Native Americans with, like, the mass graves, the ghettos, which can be compared to reservations, the residential schools, which were basically death camps for kids, you know what I mean? And yeah, there's a lot of, I think America especially has a lot of issues with the education system. They don't really teach. They say that history is written by the victors, and it's definitely true in America. Like they can write whatever they want about us, and it's considered true. I mean, it's a fact, you know what I mean? People just say, well, I learned about this in school, so it must be true. And they can meet me and I could tell them something different. They'll be like, no, they didn't teach us that in school. I don't believe you. To be honest with you, it's kind of sad to say, like, I am proud of being Native American, but like I said, a lot of my own people, they abuse the culture. It's kind of like what the Catholic Church did with the Bible, you know? They would say, like, because people couldn't read back in the day, they would say, well, if you give me money, I'll get rid of your sins for you. And my people are kind of using that longhouse religion to get rich. You know, like I said, there was a chief down there. His name was Virgil Thomas. He died and they found millions of dollars in his house, just hoarded away for no reason. And the way I look at it is, like, I do respect my culture and stuff like that, but I feel like my religion and my culture is actually doing more damage to my people than anything. It's keeping them ignorant and keeping them isolated on that reservation. So honestly, I would like to see that religion and stuff kind of fade away and see more of my people just leave the res and start mixing out, because we need to, because the inbreeding is worse than mixing out. And as far as people and the stereotypes, it does bother me kind of, but I do know that at some point we're going to have to give it up, because like I said, there's not enough of us. You know, I mean, it's cool to like remember where you come from, but I feel like being too proud of who you are kind of, like I said, it isolates you. It gets you into a bad position. It makes you kind of scared to venture out and try something different, you know? So as far as like the stereotypes, people, I mean, I appreciate the fact that like people want to know about us and stuff like that. I think that's cool. But yeah, the thing I've learned about being off the reservation though is some people are extremely, you can't call them ignorant, because ignorance is when information is being kept away from you. I would call them stupid, because information is there, but they refuse to acknowledge it. And if they don't want to change their minds about us, then I can't make them. It's, you know, it's not worth getting angry about or anything like that. I'm just trying to live my life and make something out of myself, you know. I'm more concerned about myself than I am about my people as a whole anymore. You know, I used to be really, I guess, prejudiced against, like, white people, because, you know, on the reservation, that's all they tell you is, like, oh, white people are bad, white people are bad. But then I, you know, I left the reservation, and I've been treated better by white people than I have been by my own people, you know what I mean? And, yeah, I'm glad I left the reservation, and, you know, people are gonna have their own opinions all the time. I can't really, I can't let it bother me or anything like that. Like I said, if they don't want to learn, if they don't want to listen, then, like, what can I do to change their mind? You know, you got to want to learn or want to change, you know what I mean? You can't force anybody to do that. But, I mean, I have met people, though, that are genuinely, like you, that are, like, genuinely interested in the culture, and they'll sit down and give you time and listen. If I can meet one person out of 100 that's willing to do that, then I think that's good. You know what I mean? Like, people that are just willing to listen instead of, like, having like premeditated opinions. I mean, a lot of it though, I was able to let go, because actually my father, his family's actually Irish too. But see, I could relate to that a lot though, because the Catholic Church did a lot of horrible things in Ireland too, to those people, just like they did to Native Americans. So like my full name is Mal Mackenzie Malone. My dad gave me an Irish name. And, you know, a lot of the atrocities and stuff like that, that my people went through, the Europeans were doing it to each other a long time before they ever even found America. You know what I mean? Like, the Romans were spreading out and spreading their religion. Actually, Germans, you know, Germany was right next to Rome for a long time. It was huge at one point. And the Romans were constantly coming in there and invading these people and spreading their religion, their culture, enslaving their people. You know, it was bad. I mean, like, the way I look at it is, I think everybody's been through something bad. But it's about what you do with it afterwards. You know, you can still make a good life for yourself. You can't keep blaming past atrocities on, you know, your problems today. I think you have to, like, at one point, you just have to get past it and do something better for yourself. And I would rather represent my people in a positive way, too. I don't want people to look at me and see me on the streets drunk and stuff like that and just be like, man, those fucking Indians, that all they like to do is drink. And, you know, I would rather work hard and, you know, do something with my life, be a carpenter, and have people be like, wow, you know, Native Americans are really hard workers and stuff, you know, like, basically represent my people in a more positive way, I guess, would be the way to say it. I'd just like to own a house, have a good car, start a family, you know, teach my kids. You know, I'm still actually debating on whether or not, you know, if I had kids, if I would teach them about my culture, my religion, because like I said, I kind of feel like it gives you like a, almost like a handicap, like you're kind of harping on past things that don't really matter anymore. You know, it happened, like, I can't go back in time and change any of that stuff. The only thing I can do is focus on the future. So, like, you know, I almost think that I wouldn't even bother teaching my kids anything about their culture and stuff like that. I think the best thing I could teach my kids is how to work hard, you know, and be smart. Like, my grandfather, on my father's side, he was an electrical engineer. He helped work on the atom bombs that they dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki during World War II. He's extremely smart. He's amazing at math. You know, and he had it rough growing up. I mean, you know, like, being, like, you know, it was rough, but he still did it. I mean, he took it upon himself to do it. Nobody made him go to school and stuff like that. He did it on his own, you know, and I'm proud of that, you know. And, you know, even my mother's father, you know, he was a roofer, fought in World War II. He started a farm, took care of all his kids, and he didn't let any of the past traumas of, like, being in a boarding school and stuff like that affect who he was. You know, he was a good father, good grandfather. He worked hard. And, you know, I think that's what we should be striving for. Because, you know, I didn't learn a lot of this stuff from my grandfather. It was stuff I learned from actually other people on the reservation. There's a lot of bitter people out there, you know, that, like, I think they're kind of blaming a lot of their own problems, you know, like alcoholism and stuff like that, on past traumas and stuff. And I don't think that's right. You know, it's all up to you after a while. It's like, you can't always blame, like, the way you were raised by your parents, even, on, like, how your life turned out. Sometimes it's up to you, you know, to fix things. A lot of people nowadays that are actually getting involved in the longhouse, that are getting involved in the language and the culture and stuff like that, they're doing it more or less because they know that if they learn this stuff, they get into that little inner circle, and they have access to money, and they get away with more and stuff like that. You know, a lot of their kids out there, they sell drugs and stuff like that, and it's okay because they're related to a chief or a clan mother. And they all know what's going on out there, but they just refuse to acknowledge it. It's mostly like a really sketchy system, because it's basically like the whole council, which is the chiefs and the clan mothers, they all have dirt on each other. You know, they'll say, well, your kid's selling drugs. They're like, well, your kid is too. So they're like, okay, well, we just won't say anything about it, and we'll just let it go on. You know, like, if you're not related to a chief or a clan mother, you'll go to jail for selling drugs. But if one of their kids gets caught selling drugs, they get them off. It's bad. You know, like, I mean, believe me, like, there's good things about Native American culture, but I think if you really want to know about modern day Native Americans, it's important to portray them for what they really are, instead of just trying to say, oh yeah, we're good people, we do sweat lodges and we do powwows and stuff like that. You know, like, modern day Native Americans are not what they used to be. You know, at one time we really were good people. It was cool to be Native American, but colonization has really worked. You know, they say that the oppressed will become the oppressors, and I think that really happened with us. You know, like, there's no more boarding schools, there's no more you know, wars being fought between white people and Native Americans. We're basically hurting ourselves now on the reservations. You know, it's our own people doing it to ourselves, and it's only going to get worse, I think. You know, because, like, for generations now, like I said, we've been inbreeding and stuff like that, and it's going to get out of hand pretty soon. I mean, you know, I would encourage anybody from Europe, America, anybody that wants to learn about Native Americans, to Google the Onondaga Reservation and learn something about that, because it's pretty bad. I mean, I don't like living there. I mean, I'm glad I left when I did. I mean, mostly I just want to touch on, you know, like, who we are, because, like I said, you know, most people know about, you know, the Lakota, the Navajo, like, the typical Native Americans, but I don't know how it happened, but we got swept under the rug, because, like I said, we had a huge hand during the Revolutionary War. You know, like, we picked sides with, like, you know, the English and the Americans, the colonists and stuff, and, you know, during the French and Indian War, we were heavily involved in that, and, that's about it, I guess. And the residential schools, that was another big thing, because I don't think people realize how recent this stuff happened. A lot of people think that, you know, most of these traumas and these bad things happened, like, so long ago. But, like I said, my grandfather was in one of those schools, and it, you know, it messed him up pretty bad. I think it's important for people to realize that kind of stuff and stop, I guess, like, harping on certain people. Because, like I said, like, you know, like, people like to speak about how bad the Holocaust was and stuff like that, but they don't want to talk about the atrocities that happened here in America. You know what I mean? Like, you can't go and say, like, oh, this guy was evil, but then say, like, oh, well, we were expanding. My mother's last name, like I told you last night, is actually Krause. I mean, most Native Americans won't acknowledge it. They say, oh, well, I'm full-blooded this and full-blooded that. There is no more full-blooded Native Americans. We're all mixed with something. You know, like, you need to stop trying to, like, hide, you know, your real blood and acknowledge it. You know, like I said, my father's family is from Ireland. My mother's family was probably from Germany. You know, if Europeans never found America, I could have been born in probably Russia or Ireland or Germany even. You know what I mean? Like, there's no, I mean, it's not 100% guarantee that I would have been Native American. I mean, like, a lot of people don't acknowledge that, too. Like, everybody's nowadays, especially in America, is kind of mixed with everything. You know what I mean? Nobody's 100% anything. And then you look at a place like you know, like Ireland and Scotland and stuff like that. The Vikings invaded them several times. The Romans invaded them. England invaded them. I mean, like, you know, that place has even been a melting pot for cultures for years. You know what I mean? Like, just like America. Actually, Europe in general, because, I mean, there's been so many wars and things fought, you know, in Europe that, like, over there, like, you can't tell. Like even you being German, you could have been from, your ancestors could have been from England or anything. They could have been Druids, you know? Like, there's no way to really tell. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's, like, important to be, you know, proud of who you are and stuff like that, but I think sometimes that pride makes us forget about, like, the fact that we're all human beings, just like Jim was talking about last night at the sweat, Native Americans, like I said, on my reservation, they're real kind of, like, reclusive. They don't really warm up to outsiders, which is wrong, because in our culture, that religion, you know, going into the longhouse is actually supposed to be for everybody. Just like Jim said, if somebody shows up, you're supposed to invite them in. You don't exclude people from it. You know, it's for everyone that wants to listen, that wants to accept it. You're not supposed to just shun people, basically, you know? I think that's a big part about Native American culture, too, is, like, well, in my culture, we always talked about how we're supposed to be accepting of people and stuff like that. Like, you know, before Europeans showed up, we had a time of peace. There was a guy that came to us, basically. He was like, you know, we talked about Jesus Christ and stuff like that before, he showed up to Europe, actually. There was a guy that came up. His name, they called him the Peacemaker. And he kind of calmed all our wars down between each other. Because at one point, the Oneidas, the Senecas, the Onondagas, the Cayugas, and the Mohawks, we were all at war with each other. We used to do horrible things to each other, like eat each other and all kinds of crazy shit. And this guy showed up one day, calmed everything down. And once he did that, he said that there were people across the water that needed his help. So he left. And when he came back, they said he had holes in his hands and he was bleeding out of the top of his head. And he actually kind of prophesied that someday they would come here and do the same thing to us. And he said, we're supposed to let them. Because one of the things we're not supposed to be doing is, like, murdering each other, killing each other, stuff like that. You know what I mean? Because basically judging each other, because we don't have the right to pass judgment on each other because we believe in an afterlife. You know, the judgment is left up to the Creator. Like, even things like rapists and child molesters, we're not supposed to be killing them or punishing them. What you're supposed to do is shun them, kick them out of the tribe, and basically exclude them. You know what I mean? Like, because someday they're going to, like I said, death is going to happen to us no matter what. So judgment's going to come, basically, you know? Like, it's not up to us to judge anybody, to make decisions about people's life and stuff like that. Basically, like I said, you know, you're supposed to worry about yourself.
My name is Cordell Allen Terrivio, and I see it as a government name. So I'm half Navajo, quarter Hopi, and a quarter Acoma from Sky City, New Mexico. And like I said, it's a government name the way I see it, because I'm trying to learn my traditions and our ways in the Native American way. And in the Hopi way, we have names. We have Indian names. And a couple of mine that I know of are Red Corn and Snowman. And so those are two of my Hopi names. I grew up in Arizona. I grew up in a little town called Tuba City, Arizona. It's a Navajo reservation. And I guess my parents already had a house on the south rim of the Grand Canyon. So we used to live out there for 4 or 5 years until 1999 or 2000. And that's when my grandmother from my dad's side, who's half Hopi and Acoma, and he wanted to, well, it was basically my grandma's idea to move to a little town called Cottonwood in Arizona. So we pretty much moved there and started life from there. I have been raised on my dad's side more. I do have my tribal enrollment papers for the Hopi tribe. I do have my census numbers for my Navajo side, my Hopi side, and my Acoma side. And I spent a lot of time on my dad's side of the family. We were always going back and forth between the city and the reservation. And it was something they always did, something they've always done for years. My aunt still does it till this day. So as far as the Acoma side, I've only been there once in Sky City in New Mexico. So I don't really know too much about that side, but as far as the Hopi side, there's only some things I can say, and there's also some things I can't say. So I have to be real careful on what I'm allowed to say, because our tribe it's so small that a long time ago, like I think it was like the 1600s, and what happened is that the Hopis were here first, and we had so much land, and therefore the government came over and they came into the Hopi side, and they took most of that land around it, and so we're just left with like a little bit. And so later on in time, the government came and took that land from the Hopis, and they reserved that land. And so the Navajos came out from the north, as far as I can remember. And they came over, and the government gave it to them. And they said, this is your land. And a lot of our culture on the Hopi side, they gave it to the Navajos. So they told them, this is your land and this is your culture, so turn it into what you want to believe. And so that's what the Navajos did. They took our culture and they turned it into their beliefs. And so nowadays they say that the Navajo is the biggest tribe right now in this time. The Hopis are really strong people. They're a type of pueblos. We do live on rocks that are called mesas, and our houses are made from clay. Clay, which is dirt that's pretty much like put together, and the houses are pretty much made of clay and wood, and so they would make mud, and they would make the walls from the wood, and they would pack it into the wood, the clay dirt into the wood, so we got a house. And I do follow some of those. Well, I'm trying to follow most of my traditions. It's just hard because there's some things I do know about it, and then there's some things that I'm still learning on, and there's a lot of it that I don't know about it. So I'm trying really hard to be careful with what I'm supposed to do and what I'm not supposed to do in terms of me not trying to hurt myself and others around me. So I'm trying really hard not to affect those around me and hurt myself, because it's a spiritual thing that can hurt one another. And it's hard to do, to live in this kind of world, as in our way we call it the white man world, and it's hard to live in the Native American world. So there's I'm basically living two different kind of worlds, and it's hard because there's things in this in this world that I have to live and follow by as far as the system goes, and compared to the Native American life, which is naturally given to us from the heart. So there's things I got to be careful of, and there's some things I can do in the Native American world as far as bringing it into this world. Biggest challenge for me is trying to manage it to my own understandings, where I can handle it without losing my mind over it. Because there's things here in this world that I have to go by as far as following the courts and the authorities and following what people tell me. As far as the Native American side, it's everything's pretty much like a teaching lesson. There's things that are taught to us in a certain way in this Native American way of life. And we've done that for so long. And it's just part of it's a natural thing to us. And there's things that it's hard. Like, there's things that I want to do on my Native American side, but I have to be careful because this new system that was brought to us, it has a whole different mindset. And so it's hard to manage both sides to become one. For generations, a long time ago, there's teachings where they would show us how to take care of the earth and like how to feed ourselves, as in going hunting. And nowadays, we're pretty much put in schools, and we go to stores to buy our food. So a lot of it is kind of complicated in a way. I know what I was told was that a long time ago, we used to live off the earth, and we would take from the earth, but we would also give back to the earth with tobacco. And a lot of that was taken away from us as far as brainwashing, because we were put into a situation that wasn't us. That's not the way, the Native American way. And so we basically got taken away from that side and put into schools that they want us to learn. And so looking at it, it's hard to see and understand, because of all the things they did to us. They've abused us, and they took a lot from us. They would hurt the little kids, and every time we'd speak the language, they would slap us or hit us for not speaking the English language. And so as time grew over, we had to put on clothes that to tell us that we're ashamed of being in, like, we were ashamed of our bodies, of our naked bodies. And so we were forced to put on shirts and pants and shoes and cut our hairs into this new way of life. And so that's a real hard struggle for me, because there are times that I want to like walk around without my shoes and without my socks. But then I have to remember that other people see it as kind of like a disgrace. So it's hard to do some things freely when there's a system that we have to follow in order for us not to get in trouble with the law and the authorities. On my Navajo side, hello in our language is yat e, and goodbye or just bye in the Navajo language is hakone, and like come, I forgot what come here means, or the Navajo language for come here is hoko, and that's come here for Navajo in the Navajo language. As far as my research is, we were walking and riding horses or wagons a long time ago, and trying to reconnect with this American way, it's kind of hard for me, because they they have cars and they have buses and trains, and it's hard to figure out where to go and like where the bus is gonna take me and the train to get to my destination from point A to point B. And there's different buses you have to take to get there, and you can get lost in the city because it's so big and everybody's just out to get you somehow in some way. So because I'm so used to living on the reservation with my dad and on his side of the family and my mom's side of the family, because there's a lot that I've learned out there through our traditional ways, and I still have to remember that this is a new era, and I gotta remind myself that everything is not the way it used to be. Everything has changed, and so we have to follow a way where it's gonna help us in these new days compared to what we used to have. An example would be like the money, for an example. We have to learn a way to use this money, this American money, to get what we need to buy things for ourselves. As whereas a long time ago, we would trade, we would bargain. And it would be like 4 or 5 blankets or 6 blankets just to have something from another tribe that they have as a food. And there's just things that one tribe had, another tribe needed, and so they would trade back and forth. I mean, like, honestly, everybody has their own beliefs and everybody has their own ways. And as far as California goes, in the area that we are in, is there, it's a tribe called Tongva, and this is their land, and they go off of what they believe from what their elders taught them. And so a lot of the teachings that Uncle Jimmy tells us, it comes from his tribe, from what his forefathers told him. And so as far as the Hopi side, we don't like really believe in sweat lodges. We have things that are called kivas. What it is a, like I was saying before, we live on a rock called mesas, and it's a house that's like dug into a rock. And so we dig out the inside of it and we clear it out, and there's like a ladder that comes into it. And we call those kivas in our language, in the Hopi language. And that's where we go for our prayers and meditation. As far as the sweat lodge goes, there's different sweat lodges for different tribes. And the one here on the Tongva lands, they teach us healing, where it's going back into Mother Earth and you're coming out reborn as a new person. So when we are born from our mother, we came out with nothing. And so it's the same way as going back into the earth. We go in with nothing. And we come out, we crawl out as if our mother was giving birth to a baby. And that's what the earth is doing. It's giving us rebirth to say whatever happened in the past has happened. You can't change it. So now you are a new person now, and it's time to live a better life and move on from what happened. So there's a lot of healing to it. It's unexplainable, and there's no way of describing it. It's just something that we live with, and it's something that's so sacred that it can't be bought with money. It's too sacred for us that we have to take care of it in a way and take care of each other without hurting one another. I mean, for me, honestly, I'm used to riding the buses and taking the trains. And I'm used to buying things. And I'm used to, like, watching TV and using a cell phone. So things like that get in the way because it's media that interferes with us Native Americans because we're so used to learning how to live off the earth and hunt for ourselves for food, and we're used to using these little tools that we made for us to use. And whereas nowadays there's like forks there that we can use and like silverware we can use, and there's beds for us and like houses, and I'm pretty much used to it in this new life. It's just something that we got used to over time that was given to us and say, you have to learn this. And it sucks. In a way it sucks. Because I wish everything would go back to the way it was before, where everybody was peaceful and loving and caring for the earth. And nowadays everybody's against each other. Everybody's attacking each other. And the earth is hurting because of all this pollution and all these buildings that are sitting on it. The Hopi name means peace and harmony. And so it's a reminder for me to say, yeah, they did that to us, but it also says love your enemy as you love yourself and treat everybody equally the way you want to be treated. So therefore, I have a lot of anger in it, yes, from what happened to us. But I also have to see that there are people out there that don't see it like that. And like, there are people out there that do care for us and that do like us for who we are. And they want to know more about us Native Americans. And it's a good thing for me because there are some things I know about it and there are some things I'm still learning. And as far as my teachings go, and it's an honor to hear other people, like, we want to know more about you and how you guys lived a long time ago. Because to them, in this state, to them, it's cool in a way. But for us, there's nothing saying that we discriminate one another, and there's nothing saying that we don't like you. We're very peaceful people, and we're very kind, nice and kind people. We like to give, and because we know it comes back in one way or another. And so for me, I give a lot. I have a lot of heart, and I give. And it doesn't matter how much you take from me, as long as you're taking it from me, and that's what makes me feel good. That's what warms my heart. Because I know something I'm saying or something I do is going to help them out in their own way. So even if it don't, it just says that I did something good. I did something right. So, yeah. In all of the Native American way, in every tribe, you have to do a lot just to get a feather. And you have to do a lot of work. There's basically like two kinds of feathers. There's a hawk feather and there's eagle feathers. And there's so much work you can do for a hawk feather before you can get an eagle feather. Because an eagle feather is the most sacred and it's the most high. And that's a sacred bird for us. And so there's certain types of work that you got to do to get a hawk feather before you can get an eagle feather. And to get an eagle feather, you have to do a lot of work just to get it. And it's really hard to get one of those. But nowadays, they just pass them down. nobody really follows that way because it's all dying out. Nobody's teaching the younger ones about this way of life, and nobody's teaching the kids the actual way of life to be a Native American, to live a Native American way. And so a lot of that is dying out because of this new age we're coming into. There are times that the kids want to learn, and it's how their parents raised them and how they treat them. And so it goes, it's a back and forth thing between us and kids. We see it as the kids are teaching us something. The kids are teaching us how to be happy and how to be fearless while they're running around and joyful. As whereas they look up to us as leaders, but we show them in a bad way. Because the adults use drugs and alcohol, substance use, and that's what the kids see, and they think it's okay. Hurting one another from the adults, the kids think it's okay, so they do it themselves. And so they grow up to forget who we really are. And it hurts me to see that. It hurts me to see that the kids follow our footsteps from the things we've done in the past that are wrong. And nobody's teaching them right. Nobody's teaching them the actual truth. They're just teaching them nothing but lies. And so it's hard. But I try to remind everybody that we have to look at the kids because they look up to us. And they're our future. They're the future for what they're gonna be holding for us as we pass it to them. So it just sucks that it's dying out from what we're doing to each other. There are some people out there that do say they're Cherokee, and there's some people out there that do say they're Blackfoot. But it's just something that they're doing to make fun of us. And just like with the naming, I was initiated in the Hopi tribe, and I was given two names for my grandma and my uncle. And my grandma gave me Red Corn, and my uncle gave me Snowman. And I was initiated into the tribe, and I earned those names because of the things I'm doing or the things I have done. And so for someone to give themselves the names is it's disrespecting the whole Native American culture because it's not the right way. They're making fun of us. And they think it's funny that we do these things and we believe in these ways. And to them, they think it's funny, but to us, it's something that we've always done, and it's a sacred thing to us. I mean, like I said before, it's something unexplainable, and I can't describe it. It's just that means a lot to us because Creator is the guy sitting upstairs. He's grandfather in the sky, and he's the one that made us, and he's the one that gave us breath of air. And so to appreciate that and acknowledge that, we love ourselves and we give back to what he gave us. As far as the earth gave us trees and it gave us animals and it gave us plants that we can heal ourselves. And we got to give back to the earth before it all goes away and it disappears. And no one's really doing that. Everybody's taking out from the roots. Everybody's picking out plants from the roots and cutting down the trees from the roots, and there's nothing growing. So we try to maintain in a certain way. We try to conserve in a certain way before it all disappears. Because this is where everything started for me. This is where I learned about myself and who I am and where my tribe comes from. And so I've always, I didn't, for me, I didn't want to bother with it. I thought it was just something that was funny and humiliating. But now that I see how much greatness it has to offer me, it's amazing just to follow the right way. To be taught something that I'm actually starting to love and embrace and cherish every moment of it. Because I have a lot of passion for my Native American side. And I have a lot of passion for this land. And I always look to the sky and I always tell Creator, thank you. Thank you for what you've given us today. And thank you for the air you've given us today. Please make it good for us and make it great for us as the day goes by. And blessings are received. Blessings are received.
My name is Rachel Cooper. I am Choctaw and Blackfoot. And my father's white, my mother's Native and white. I'm from Los Angeles, born and raised here in Los Angeles. When my grandmother had my mom never knew her father because her father was killed by a drunk driver when my mom was a baby. And so my grandmother, being a nurse and getting help from her tribe and from people, moved to Glendale, California, and with my mom as a single parent and raised her. During that time, she had nobody, you know, not that many connections out here that were Native, nobody to talk to. That's how, you know, her language was pretty much lost. My grandmother doesn't really know that much of even her own language anymore, even though she was raised around her tribe. And even my mother's first language was Choctaw, and she lost it when they moved to California too. So it was due to relocation. And then my mother married a white man, my father. And so I was never raised around it ever. I mean, there was some confusion, actually. I mean, for me growing up, I didn't know who I related to, you know, because I didn't quite fit in with Caucasian people, and there weren't very many Natives. But there were a lot of Hispanic children. And so for a little bit of time when I was in junior high school, I would tell people that I was Hispanic, even though I wasn't, just because I was trying to fit in. So I didn't quite, you know, it was hard for me trying to figure out where I fit in and who I fit in with. You know what? It's still kind of difficult for me because I can identify being both Caucasian and Native. And clearly, when people ask me what I am, clearly I don't look like it's hard to gauge it because people generally think that I'm Persian or some kind of European descent, which I do have European descent, but nobody ever guesses that I'm Native. And so I still, you know, being here, I want to know more about the culture, but I don't know anything about it. And there are some girls here that do know a lot about the culture. And so there are times when I feel like a little bit of an outsider, you know, coming in and, you know, relating to Caucasian people. I mean, clearly when you talk to me, you know, I sound like I was born in a Caucasian family. However, I don't look like it. So, you know, I'm just, it's where do I fit in? I don't know. I guess I can fit in everywhere. I mean, even on a personal level, I'm still trying to figure out what it means to me. I'm trying to get some kind of understanding of what the history of it is, what my own history is. I would like to go to some powwows. You know, I know there's one for my tribe once a year, which I have been wanting to go to for quite some time now, but I miss because it's once a year and I haven't planned for it. But I think that I could better answer that question once I actually, you know, figure out what it means to me on a personal level. I definitely would have loved to had more of a history lesson as far as my family background is concerned. But I think that when you are raised a certain way, you're not really missing something. It's just becomes who you are. And, you know, so I have come to accept that this is who I am. And it's my choice whether or not I want to seek out more information in my culture or not. I mean, everything is going to be a new beginning for me when I leave here. I'm going to get back in touch with my family and start a new life, go back to school. I want to go to school for jewelry making. I really like school a lot. I've been learning German on my own with this app called Duolingo. It's really, my phone broke, so I had to stop, but I've been doing it. I think part of my ancestry is German. I've got some English in me, Bohemian, Dutch, Irish, you know, there's a lot of, yeah, broad family history, but you know, German, it seems like it's an interesting language to learn. I probably should learn Spanish, but I think that there's something that diversity is good. You know, it's always good to expand your horizons as far as your culture is concerned. And maybe with me being somewhat of a blank slate as far as culture, then that means that I'm more teachable and I can open my mind to more ideas as far as, you know, the interests of different cultures and take from everything. I think that, you know, with anything in life, you know, you can take what you want out of it and use it and leave whatever you don't agree with. You know, if there's something that I find that I agree with in this culture or that I like, and I'm sure there's a lot of different things, like their ways, they're very respectful of women, which I love. And the culture is very family oriented, helping one another. And there's definitely a lot of bonding, brotherhood and sisterhood and respecting of elders. You know, it's all very important and it's a learning experience. And I think that in life, there's, you know, there's a lot of good lessons for how to live in life in this culture. Just like I think that there's probably a lot of good lessons in other cultures in how to live in life. And it's just, you know, learning from each culture is amazing. I don't think just one is right. I think that there's a lot to learn from the culture, and it would be nice if a lot of the ways were brought into modern society. I'm not talking about everybody having to go into a sweat lodge, but you know, when it comes to the love and care of one another, you know, modern society could be reminded of that kind of, you know, that kind of behavior in a lot of different areas and of society. Not to say everybody's like that, but a lot of people in the world, I feel like technology has put a wall between people and their and bonding. I don't think that people have the conversations that they used to have with one another. You know, there's a lot of people that are on the phone with each other and forgetting how to even interact in a family setting, helping one another, you know, even clean a house or sitting at a dinner table together, you know?
My name is Damian Goki, and I'm from Seminole, Oklahoma. Wasn't really born on the res, but I grew up off the res in Seminole. I was born in Shawnee, Mission Hill. They closed that hospital down ever since, but I'm Sac and Fox Indian, Seminole Indian. my ancestors walked a trail of tears, but I grew up pretty rough. My dad was out of the penitentiary. He was a 2-time Golden Glove boxer. My mom, she was a good woman. She had me at the age of 18, though. You know, pretty young. I grew up fighting a lot. I grew up in a pretty broken home. You know, it's kind of sad, but we traveled a lot. You know, when I was young, my dad was a journeyman electrician. My mom, she did what she could. You know, she was a CNA nurse, I think. She helped out. She did, like, providing for elders and stuff. That was her thing. But my dad was very abusive, I think. And he was... They drank a lot and partied a lot. I know that. I don't know the true story of why they broke up or what happened. But I know that I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, living there with my dad for the longest. And I would be cleaning and cooking if I wasn't going to school or doing my homework. My dad would be either at work or at the bar. Sometimes he'd come in drunk and everything went ship shape. I'd get whooped a lot. The kids did stuff. It wasn't them that got whooped, it was me. And I think that's where I get a lot of my experience in traveling, because I used to run away when I was a kid, and I used to stay in boxcars, sleep at people's houses, and then wake up in the morning and take off. But I know when it's like not too, I know when it's not too much I don't know. All right, so whenever problems start coming about, I tend to take off. I'll run far. That's always been my problem. So my baby mother, I've got 5 kids now. I've got 3 girls and 2 boys. Beautiful kids. I love my kids. I got 3 baby mamas, though. You know, I'm a sucker for love, a real sucker for love. And it's not me being abusive. It's just, you know, the drugs and the alcohol. My girlfriends or my baby mothers, they some of them are, you know, certified crazy or, you know, straight drunk. And one is, she's heavy on meth and heavy on drinking, you know. She's abusive to her kids, too. I just can't take, you know, a abusive relationship or, you know, just too much complication. When it starts to become overwhelming, I leave. So I finally got tired of stuff. You know, my sister's seen it in me, and she helped me get to Houston, Texas, and I did a little work there. And she ended up, her and her old man got in a fight, so I ended up staying in the apartment by myself for a couple of weeks, and then I went and got me a tent, and I stayed out in the woods trying to find jobs and stuff. And I got talked into going back to Oklahoma. Needless to say, it was, it could have been the end there for me too. I managed to escape from a bunch of bad stuff, and I hitchhiked to Florida last year around this time, and I made it there to Jacksonville. Worked as a fencer, building fences. I went to Orlando, you know, had dreams making it there. My mother, I contacted my mother and let her know, you know, that I was still alive. And she was in Oregon. I've got a family in Oregon. I'm descended in Klamath as well. Klamath, Oregon. It's a big family there. Anyway, she was there. She talked me into going up there to Oregon around August last year. I went up there. I met a lot of my family, you know. I took my kids up there. I have my kids up there, and the baby mother, she stayed behind for about a month, and then she came up there, and I had a job offer a little after she came up to work in a catering crew for fighting, wildland firefighting. So we were serving, we were cooking for, you know, anywhere from like 900 firefighters. I mean, it was awesome. It was an awesome job. Came to almost getting burning down, you know, but it was pretty good. It was pretty fun. And the guy come back and they were gone. A kid was murdered there in Chiloquin, Oregon, where we were all living. And I think my two older stepkids, her kids, were kind of involved in it. And, some family had threatened to, you know, to threaten my stepkids. And so my baby mother took all the kids and had left without saying anything. And when I came back from work, they were all gone. Everything was gone. Even my mother was gone. Come to find out that they found out who was responsible for it days later. And she didn't even need to leave. But I think it was an excuse so that she can go back to doing drugs and drink and stuff. So the only ones that are getting hurt out of this was the kids. It left me in a little bit of a predicament. And I had a lot of money. And I was really upset with her at the time. And I turned to drinking, then drugs. And I had girlfriends, you know. It was a wild time with the money I had. Instead of trying to be productive with it, I counterproductive myself, and I beat myself up day in and day out if I wasn't drunk, you know. but I ended up making it here. You know, it was getting cold up there. There wasn't really any work, so I decided to come here. And to LA, see if I can't find a job, maybe, you know. And I was at the food stamp office in Compton, you know, living on the streets. I got stabbed in Hollywood. And so I was still stitched up, trying to heal up. I think it was like 3 days after I got stabbed. And I seen that brother James, running wild running horse. And that's whenever I came here. I tried to come here, but they was like, well, you got to wait until your stitches heal up and make sure you ain't got no infection. So I had to wait about 2 weeks, and then I got here. And I was desperately hungry, I'll tell you what. It's mean on the streets. It's nothing nice. You know, I grew up a fighter, so I mean, you know, survive. I've done survival a lot, so I mean, I pretty much kept myself in shape. But after I got stabbed, it was, you know, it was kind of tough to move around. And I kind of threw my shoulder out from fighting off my attacker, you know. Within all that, you know, I still believe in my creator. And I believe my ancestors are still looking out for me. I don't talk my story, you know, because I don't think I can tell it well. But it's been a wild adventure, I'll tell you what. The people I've met, the things I've seen, the wonders, the beautiful, you know, all the beautiful mountainside, the landscaping, everything. It's been awesome, you know. I wish I had a film of my own to film everything I did. It was beautiful. I mean, the hitchhiking I did, I walked a lot of miles, rode a lot of miles, and I've seen a lot of beautiful sunsets. And there are beautiful people, then there are ugly people, you know? Then there's wolf in sheep's clothing. Oh, man. But, you know, it's one heck of a road, man. It's one heck of a ride. But now, you know, I'm working on talking to my baby mother about my youngest kids, the one that has the youngest ones. I forgot to mention, I have there's six of us through my mother, and then there's about at least 14 through my father kids. So I've got a lot of family. My mom, she's a half Klamath, and she is half Seminole, a little German, a little Irish. My dad, he's a little half Mexican, and he's a Miami and Sac and Fox. he was a respected man in the Sac and Fox tribe. They did him some honors. I remember that before he died. Yeah, he passed away in 98. He was a strong man, but he loved women. I'll tell you that. And I think that was his downfall. He died of AIDS in 98. My mom, she still lives. She's in Oklahoma, you know. She's married. I don't know how happy. You know, she cries to me on the phone still, you know. Wish I could do a lot for her, but going back to that life would be just going back to drinking, back to drugs. I can't do that no more. I'm tired of it. I'm so tired of it. I'm planning to go back to school and do work here, you know, get my kids, maybe, you know, provide for them a life I never have, let them see the world. And maybe, you know, see the world through their eyes, and, man, you know, live a great life from here on out. That's pretty much it. And I miss my kids so bad that it's like I felt like I was losing myself to just sorrow, just, you know, having that pitiful me. You know, I had that pitiful me for the longest, and then after the guy stabbed me. Kind of woke my spirit up, you know, shook me up. Whoops. I felt like I almost died, you know. And from that point on, I remember trying to get out of that medical bed and just trying to take off and, you know, just find myself. That's what I wanted to do, is find something that, you know, get me back on my feet, you know, and maybe I can go see my kids before I die, because this... I don't want to die right now. I want to see my kids. And so I've got to talk to them here lately. That I told them every minute I love them, you know. And the baby mother, I've spoken to her, and she plans to be here sometimes at the end of the month. She's in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And, She's surrounded by the drugs, and that's all she knows there is drugs and alcohol. So her family is embarrassed. She tells me her family is embarrassed by her, actions. She's been kicked out of all her houses now. She's got nowhere else to go, really, you know. people that she knows, they ain't doing nothing for her but feeding her drugs and alcohol. So nobody's willing to help her. I was the only one to ever help her. Whenever I'm around, everybody wants to help, you know, because they see that I'm always productive around my kids, for my kids. And I don't ask for their help, but they insist. But when it's her alone, when she does stuff like this, she loses her temper too much, and she'll take it either out on the kids, or she'll go out and drinking, trying to hang out with her friends, or leave her kids here and there. Kids are split up right now, so when she gets here, they'll all be together. Not all of them. The two older ones are still up there with my family, and they're just my stepkids. But my family has taken them in as their own. It's a blessing. One's to graduate this year. The oldest, her name is Taitlin Renee Webb. And she's an awesome little girl, you know. She's got beyond potential. She's 17. Graduating this year, and she's awesome. She's ready to learn. She loves it up there. I don't know about her brother. He's 15. He's more, I don't know. He wants to hang around his mom a lot, you know, and they've seen her lifestyle. And I know Taylin's ready to move from there and move on and do something great with their life. You know, I've spoken to her about it, you know, and I try to push it on all the kids. You know, every one of them have the potential to be something better than anybody or anything that's they've ever lived around, you know. I tell them that. I say, go explore, you know. Go out there and explore all these places that, you know, none of these people in Oklahoma have, you know. Maybe get into the Army, or, you know, she loves photography. She loves photography. She's doing photography classes. You know, I helped her get her a Nikon, and it's got all those extra lenses and stuff. So, you know, hopefully she's putting them to use. I think I've gotten her just a little cool pics as well, you know. And she's already had another Nikon, but she's got, you know, multiple, you know, cameras. So she's got photography going on for her, and she's graduating, and she's passing. And, I mean, I can't be more proud of her. You know, I wish I could be there now. But, like I said, I'm worried about these kids, you know. My girls, the baby girls, are in Oklahoma City, and I don't trust no one around them, you know. Just as long as they're around me, I know they're safe, you know. And I know that she'll get frustrated off the littlest things, and she'll leave them kids, and I don't know who she leaves them with. So I have to have her come here. I'm sacrificing. I'm sacrificing what I'm holding against her. I'm letting it all go so that whenever she gets here, I'm willing to set things to the side and work with everything for my girls. Gabriella Marcelis and Tessa Bella. Those are the little ones. Those are the girls. And then there's Hayden. He's my boy. And Alan Jr. Two of them are my stepkids, and Gabriella and Hayden are my two, my boy and my girl. I love them dearly. Like I said, my family was, they're always partying, so I've known the party life since, you know, probably about 5 or 6. I was told by my mother that, you know, she was smoking weed with me since I was 4 years old, you know, getting me high. And she remembers the first time I got high, I ate 4 bowls of cereal and went to sleep. So I didn't see nothing bad about it, but you know, that was my first addiction. I remember alcohol always playing a part. Like whenever my mom and dad would play, throw parties, they would have all kind of drunks, in the house, passed out. And I remember I would go drink their beers when I was young, you know, and there was a lot of parties, you know, smoking cigarettes, probably around six, seven years old. Things got to where it was getting hard for my dad, I guess. And by the time I was 11 years old, he had dropped us off to my mother, where she was in Seminole, Oklahoma. My dad was in Tulsa, and he dropped us five to my mom. There were six, but my sister Cassandra Nicole, she was adopted by my aunt Hokti, and she raised her separately all her life from us. And man, I still haven't been able to sit down and ask her or have her tell me her life. We were always partying. Since I was 11. With my mom, five kids, we were always in and out of houses. Mom was always drinking, different boyfriends. You know, I got beat up, you know, when I was young. I used to track my mom down and try to find her, to bring her home so that, you know, we didn't know how to hunt for food. You know, we didn't know how to, you know, get food. And sometimes she would leave us food stamps and sometimes she wouldn't, you know. I used to get made fun of at school because we was always wearing either hand-me-downs or, you know, rags. That's where I learned to fight, you know, there. And then trying to stay on the res with the other little natives, you know, they're all rough. So we got roughed up too. Fighting, playing basketball. That's about all we did on the res. Fight and play basketball until we got, you know, a little older, maybe 13. We started drinking a lot, going in stores. We call it wahooing. And we go in the stores and grab as much beer as we can. And have the clerk distracted until we get to the door and yell out, "Wahoo! Wahoo!" And we try to make off with much as beer as we could, you know, while they chase us down the road or until we got into a car or anything, pick up, and we'd go off drinking. We did a lot of that. We found people who were willing to trade us food stamps for beer, or, you know, I was starting selling weed around that time, and so that would be, you know, a source of, you know, getting alcohol. But at the time, at the same time, I was having to try to provide for my younger brothers and sisters too. So I mean, you know, I was around 14, 15. No, I was 14 years old. I was 14 years old, and my mother got tired of it. That she was drinking herself and drugging herself. And I guess, you know, out of the blue, she accused my sister of messing with somebody, with one of her boyfriends. I think her boyfriend was, you know, trying to mess with her, but I don't know. I just remember waking up, fighting my mother back, trying to keep her from beating my sister. And she asked me, are you with me or are you against me? And I was like, just tired of you hitting us, Mom, you know, and I'm not going to let you hit my sister anymore. And she kicked us out of the house. So 14 years old, I was out on the streets. I always made sure my sister had a place to stay. Eventually she let my sister come back, you know. I wasn't allowed back, you know, so whenever I could, I'd go see my brothers and sisters while my mom was on the binge, whenever I knew my mom was on the binge. And I would take them food, you know, or I'd bring cigarettes for my sister, you know, whatever I could. Just hanging around gangs, you know, hanging around the Bloods. And Man, it was pretty hard. I got into a bunch of trouble. My dad was still alive at that time, and my mom, I tried to, you know, I got tired of getting chased by the police, and I got tired of hanging around the wrong crowd. And I was trying to ask my mom for help, and she dropped me off in Tulsa. And a sprained wrist right here and a big old fat lip from running from the police and hurting myself, and it was crazy. So 14 till now, I've always been on the streets. I tried to live with my dad. He helped me to, you know, get a job. He kind of forced me out when I was 17 of his apartment. It was a little bitty apartment, one bedroom apartment. And kind of forced me out. I had some friends, you know, I stayed with. I was working at an amusement park and working at a restaurant. It was pretty fun for a little while, you know. And then I found out my dad had died of AIDS. And then that, within a month of his burial, I had did my first sweat with my tribe, with my Sac and Fox tribe, my elders. We did sweat lodge there in his remembrance, I guess. And then, you know, went back to the streets. It was rough, you know. And then 21 is when I met my girlfriend and my first baby mother. I had two kids by her. And all the way to 24, I believe. 24. I had Alicia, my oldest, in Dayton. And them two, I love them. But she, that woman, she was, I guess she was seeing one of my friends, my partners, behind my back. And after we broke up, and I didn't know she was telling my kids that was his dad, that he was the dad. So she was drawing child support off of me, but, you know, not allowing me to see my kids. And plus, I was always on the street anyway, so I was always on drugs. I know my kids are probably mad at me for that. I tried with another girl, Lavina, my girlfriend, and she became my baby mother. We had a daughter named Winter. We got a daughter named Winter together. She's a good woman, but yeah, she was certified. All my girlfriends are native, though, you know. They're all native women. Yeah. They're all, you know, just lived on the bad side of town, you know. That's how I met them. It was on the bad side of town, always drinking. I was always on drugs. I was introduced to crystal meth and coke when I was 16. I would always, you know, when I get paid or if I, you know, did my hustles, I would always try out little this, a little that, little meth, little coke. You know, I'd always be smoking weed. I'd always be drinking. I'd always have a cigarette in my hand. You know, I've always been in fights. I've got scars to prove it all over. I never really been caught for anything. You know, I was pretty good at not being caught. Yeah, I can run and not be caught. And, you know, I look either Mexican or, you know, there's, and then Oklahoma is native country. So you can tell none of us apart, you know. Wild savages, what we were, you know. kicking indoors, for the means of getting paper to get drugs, you know, basically. I ran into my baby mamas. We had the kids. I love all my kids, but drugs and alcohol, you know, that's the worst. You know, I feel like a failure at it. But then finally, I got caught. I got caught up selling dope. I was selling meth. And I was still pilfering people's houses, going through their houses. The guy I went to sell, he was fighting with this woman. He's known for ratting anyways, working for the cops. And his girl had a crush on me, I guess, at that time. Or she did whenever she was in school, whenever I knew her. But I don't know what the case was. He decided to call the cops on me. And I had just what I had a little left of dope. And the police pulled up on me. They couldn't find the dope. But eventually they found it on me. And they gave me 5 years to do, or drug court. And I signed for drug court. Because I wasn't done partying yet. This is back in 2009, 2010. And I ran for the law till 2012. And I got caught up. By that time, I had a whole slew of charges. It all wrapped up to one. They sent me away for 3 years. It was a 10 nonviolent, my first drug charge, my only drug charge. And I went to prison, and there's where I obtained my GED, my welding license, my certification. So I'm welding certified, MIG, TIG, Flux. Throughout my history, I always job jumped too. I've always worked, you know. I got cooking capabilities. I can cook. I work. I can, you know, do anything around the house. I love working with my hands. So, anyways, I got out. I had a girlfriend named Maggie Lena, and she helped me settle down, kind of. But you know, just I had anxiety real bad. You know, just kind of had that mindset where I was in prison still, you know, kind of, you know, the freedom was kind of scary and little, you know, not used to it, you know. 3 years, it didn't seem long, but whenever, you know, you're fighting at first, and then you suddenly succumb to, you know, to being locked up, being told what to do and when to eat, you know. And then they let you go. It just seems like, you know, you're trying to fit back in, but it just doesn't seem real. You know, I'd have dreams and nightmares of being free, you know. Even whenever I was the day of my release, I didn't know that I had a warrant for me. And none of the people in the institution told me I had a warrant until the moment of my release. And they say it was against law, but I don't know. So the day of my release, I signed all my papers to be released. Then they slapped the cuffs on me and told me, you've got a warrant somewhere. You're going to have to sit here and wait till they come pick you up. And then they took me off to Seminole County. And anyways, whenever I got out, I ran into my girlfriend Maggie, and she helped me get into Heat and Air School. There, that's where I got my certifications for Heat and Air, you know. And right when it was all over with, we started drinking and partying, drugging, and it all went downhill from there. And that's when my sister took me to Houston. drinking and drugging didn't stop. You know, her and her old man, they got in a fight. They left me there, you know, pretty much. I loved it in Houston. You know, Houston was pretty fun. I'll tell you what, even in prison, you know, the elders were, you know, trying to teach me songs, telling me about my ancestral ways. You know, I'll listen to some of the old stories. I've been to powwows. I've been to, you know, I've watched them drum. I've been to, you know, ceremonies where they did stomp dance or, you know, man, you know, that's where I get a lot of my native pride. You know, it's where I hold strong to, you know, being a native. You know, I'm proud to be native, but, you know, it's just, you know, I'm weak against, you know, the drugs and the alcohol because I know it so well, you know. But that's, you know, that's what I'm ready for, the change. You know, I feel like, you know, there's something else better than all that. You know, it's just getting out and finding it. And I think that's what I've been doing, is just trying to find, you know, what it is, you know, that's out there that's better, you know. In Oklahoma, you know, it's nice. There's great people there, you know. But in the same sense, it's a lot of destruction, you know. It's not growing, you know. I can't raise my kids there because, you know, I've known so many people there that drink and drug, you know, from Tulsa to Oklahoma City. And it's just like, it's detrimental to everything I'm trying to do. You know, being here, they've got the native culture. It may not be from my culture, but it's, you know, it's something to work with. I can relate to it, you know. And, you know, I don't know nobody here, and these are all great people here. Everybody I've met here has been cool, except for the people on the streets, you know. Even the people on the streets were pretty cool. You know? I didn't starve too bad, you know. There's some days I did, but you know, the culture was, you know, nice. I wish I could, wish I had the money to run with the powwows and run with all the, you know, the natives, how they ran. But it just seems like I kept falling back, you know, I kept falling back into the old ways of drinking and drugging, the bad side of it, you know. I mean, there's good sides to it. I've seen good people, you know. I've seen some good people. I've met good people. We talk, you know. You know, we've philosophized, you know, all the old ways, and you know, they try to mentor me, but it just seems like, you know, as soon as we're done with our conversation, you know, I go back out to my house or anything, I'm running into brothers who are having problems, and when I start helping them, and their repayment is, you know, alcohol, or, you know, here, have this, you know, weed, or, you know, I got a bunch of this, man, you can have it, you know, meth or something. And seeing as I'm being weak, I'll take it in. And really, you know, whenever we have I always was taught, you know, if another, you know, man gives you something, you shouldn't turn it down. But it's not just that, but, you know, just me being weak against drinking and drugs, you know, it's hard to say no. Everybody, you know, you fit in the suit that you know, you come from. And if you don't fit in, and you try to be, you know, black, or you try to be hanging out with the whites, I mean, and if the, you know, the brothers see that, they're not going to let you in their circle, you know. But here, it doesn't matter that way, you know. I see Indians hanging with Mexicans and blacks, and it's more open, you know, kind of what they call it, like intertribal. But where I'm from, yeah, it's kind of a no-no. You don't really do that. I grew up a lot with natives. And then in the prison, it's the same way. You can't really socialize. I was a barber in penitentiary too. So, I mean, I was limited to who I cut. And then my Indian brothers, I cut for free, no matter what. Whenever I had stuff, I broke bread with my brothers. We sweated together, we fought together. When we got in trouble together, when I was raised up on the res, we always looked out for each other. But nowadays, they're turning on each other for the drugs, Nowadays, it's different. It's way different. That's why I had to leave, because I couldn't trust none of my brothers. If I wasn't letting them in my house, they was probably trying to get in my house, Or they were trying to, mess with my woman or, one or the other. Or they were trying to, push the dope on me so, we could go out and get messed up. And, they was just trying to carry me around until all the dope was gone. Or if I had money, they was trying to carry me around until the money was gone. And it just didn't feel like the old times, It just started feeling like, everybody was trying to be sneaky through something. There was an angle to something, Like they had ulterior motives, but that could have been the drugs talking too. But man, it's just didn't feel sane, I had to leave. Like I said, when it becomes overwhelming, it's time to get out of there. And I don't see myself going back anytime soon. I think there are the sneaky ones. There's the sneaky ones that do the operations with the blacks, the whites and the Mexicans that are big time dealers, to flood it in. It's flooded in somewheres. I never really investigated myself. I mean, I was in prison, and in March 20th, 2015, I got out in November of 2015. But in March, my sister was murdered. She was beaten and shot in the head, execution style. Her and another native brother, he was IBH, and he was beaten and shot too, and I believe it was over drugs, So I never got the full story on it. They have the shooter, but he wasn't the only one, because he's kind of a skinny cat, He might have shot my sister and shot old boy. And, but I know he definitely didn't beat both of them up. And, I think it has to do with the gangs. Think of it, a lot of it's the gangs, the Bloods and the Crips trying to flood it in. And, I think my sister was made an example of, that's another reason why I couldn't stay there. It just seemed like, I think, most of it was people in the city, like Oklahoma City. I think it was, gangs from there. Because, after I got out, I tried to investigate my sister's murder. And it was the Crip gang that was trying to either sabotage my investigation or just set me up to be murdered as well. It was a trip. I somehow was introduced to more drugs than I could possibly see. I was dropped off in the middle of the city to people I didn't even know. And it was like, I think I would have been murdered if I didn't have that, that gut instinct, If I would have been any more high, than I was, I think I would have been murdered that day. I escaped, and I could feel there was a high tension of something going on, you know. And the place where I was, it was flooded with a bunch of, you know, gangsters, you know. And I think they were there to stop my investigation of who was actually behind murdering my sister. So, I forgot all about that till now. It's wild. I believe it was gangs. I believe in everything that it was gangs. They're trying to, you know, flood it in, kill our res, get what they could from our people, you know. I think it's extremely hard. I think it's like the Trail of Tears all over again, you know. But, you know, I'm seeing these native rappers, you know, they're trying to speak on it. I mean, I commend them. There are, you know, the native legislation. I don't see them really involved into it too much. You know, I think they try. But if they could just, you know, go back to the res and stay there for some time, you know, months at a time, and see actually how things are going down, maybe they can get a better view and they can help out. You know, they will know where to help out, you know. Or, you know, if there's anybody that wants to help out, maybe they should camp out near the res and maybe keep an eye and see how things, you know, fall out. You know what I mean? But until that happens, you know, I think set up for, you know, downfall, you know. A lot of set up for downfall. Alcohol being one of the main contributors. Gangs with, you know, unlimited supply of dope. It just seems like it's just one, if it ain't one thing, it's another. You know, it's a shame because, you know, the native people have something to give to this life, you know. I believe that, you know, the natives have, you know, they got good crafts, they got good stories, they got, you know, they got good traditions, they got, you know, lessons that can be learned, and that there's tons of contributions from the natives that can be, you know, expressed and given to, you know. And in the way of our life, it just seems like it's disregarded, you know. And it's, nobody sees how, you know, beautiful this life is, you know, this beautiful way of life. It's amazing, you know. It's outstanding. I love it, you know. Whenever I catch glimpses of it, you know, it raises my spirit. You know, I want to get further into it. You know, I want to be part of it. You know, I want to learn how to bead. I want to learn how to, you know, make a bow and arrow. You know, I want to, you know, all that. I want to learn how to play stick ball, throw hatchets. You know, I want to, you know what it is to hunt and skin elk and deer. You know, learn how to cut my meats and know what it feels like to distribute to my people that need it the most, you know. I've been there. I've seen it. I've done it. Man, it's beautiful. It's the awesomeness, you know. It's like one with nature, being one with nature, brother, you know. That's it, you know. I see all these people trying to be, you know, in their fancy cars, you know, doing the most with technology. That's great. That's cool. But man, where we come from, you know, how we did it back then, it was just one with, you know, just like breathing, you know, being one with nature. And your spirit just soars, brother. Seeing that nature out there, exploring, hunting, you know, just hiking, you know, knowing what elements are coming. Or what elements there are around you, survival, you know. And then the stories you tell around the campfire, amazing stories, you know. All the blessings that, you know, Mother Nature has given us. I mean, being Native, you know, one finds his path. You know, one's got to find his path. And whenever one closes, you know, he's either got to make do where he's at, or he's got to, you know, drift until either he makes his own camp. But I'm here. It's going to be my camp here. It's where I'm going to raise my tribe. That's what I'm going to do for mine. You know, you got your nations of your tribes, and then you got clans within those tribes, you know. But, you know, I'm from the Wind Clan of my tribe, of my mother's tribe. And my father's tribe is a Wolf Clan. So, being that in Seminoles, Sac and Fox, I've always been a lone wolf in the wind. Ah, yeah, I like that. A lone wolf in the wind. So I've always been out to find my own. You know, I got my cubs now and they need me the most. But before I you know, we make a den to where we're going to sit up and grow, I've got to find myself. And I've got to find a good place where we can harvest, you know, good food, good for our soul, for our minds, you know. And I believe this is it, because we're right here south of Oregon, and I'm always welcome up there with my family up there to hunt. And maybe I'll take my kids up there later. We can go hunting up there, and you know, bring back some food, you know, bring it down here and break bread with these brothers here, you know. It's all about what you put in. And I believe, you know, no matter where we go, I always carry my ancestors with us. And I'll let my kids know, you know, how things came to be. And, you know, I've got some of my tribe's language that I'm learning right now. So I'm gonna instill that into my kids as well. So I'm not trying to lose none of my relations with my people, my ancestors. You know, I've got storybooks, you know, of the elders. You know, I'm grateful for that. You know, that way, you know, my kids can pass that on to their kids. But Long Beach is going to be a home to us. This is where we're going to reside. This is the den. Yeah. It's, you know, they say imitation is the greatest compliment. And, you know, I can dig that. I mean, I would invoke those that try to imitate us to, you know, come down here and camp out. Camp out near the res. If you can't camp out on the res, camp out near it. And watch how we really do it. And, you know, you can take it back to their people and powwow then, you know. I come on down, you know. The water's fine. Get you some of that. Take that back to your people, you know. You know, you can make what you want of it from there, you know. I'm from the south, you know. I hold no grudges against no man. But if you imitate us, do it right.